I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a conversation about Gitmo detainees with a lawyer helping and heading, rather, to defend one and a Pentagon advisor hoping to try six others. But first, Arizona Senator John McCain today emphatically denied that he'd ever been too close to a female lobbyist. The New York Times first reported last night that on the eve of McCain's first presidential campaign in 2000, his advisors became so worried about his relationship with lobbyist Vicki Eisman, they blocked her access to the senator and warned the two to steer clear of each other. Further, the paper suggested McCain showed favoritism for the lobbyist's clients, which included companies with businesses overseen by the Senate Commerce Committee McCain served on. Here's McCain's response today when asked, was he told by advisors to be careful?
No.
No meeting ever occurred?
No.
No staffer was ever concerned about a possible romantic relationship?
If they were, they didn't communicate that to me.
Did you ever have such a relationship?
No.
Holly Bailey is national political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She was at today's press conference in Toledo, held by Senator McCain and his wife, Sidney. Holly, your impressions?
What really struck me is how much Sidney McCain and John McCain really tried hard to smile through that, the whole thing, and to stay positive. Along the side, there were several aides there who had flown overnight to be here with him today, and they looked a little nervous. But, the fact is that the McCain campaign knew this story was coming. I think they thought part of it was dead because they had been dealing with the New York Times for several months. They weren't taken surprised by it. They were surprised a little bit by the timing, but they're definitely in pushback mode today.
Well, McCain says he knew nothing about his staff warning Vicki Eisman away, but the Washington Post reports that the man who did that was John Weaver, one of McCain's closest confidants until he left the McCain campaign a few months ago.
Right, and that's one of the most interesting aspects of this story. I mean, John Weaver used to be basically a shadow to McCain until he left the campaign last summer. And since then, Weaver has occasionally still talked to McCain. He doesn't work formally for the campaign, but he talks to Mark Salter, another one of Senator McCain's longtime aides, on a regular basis. I asked Mark Salter this morning whether he was aware of Weaver's conversations with this lobbyist. They both denied it. And that's sort of interesting because, did Weaver act unilaterally? It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, both McCain, Vicki Eisman, and McCain's wife, Cindy McCain, deny that there was any romantic involvement. But Senator McCain does say this was a friend. So let's move to the business allegations, because this came at a time when McCain had just sort of recovered after a decade of building up his reputation as being a crusader for stricter ethics. He'd been caught up in the Keating scandal. He'd, some say, recovered from that. This would be in that time frame. And it's alleged that he twice wrote letters in 1999 to the Federal Communication Commission on behalf of Paxson Communications. Now, Vicki Eisman was a lobbyist for Paxson. And Paxson's chief executive was also a major contributor to McCain. What did Senator McCain say of writing letters on behalf of one of this lobbyist's companies?
These Paxson letters came out back in 2000 when McCain was running for president the first time. At the time, and as he did today, he denied any wrongdoing. At the time, back in 2000, they released a whole, box of letters that he had written to other agencies on behalf of people, sort of trying to make the point that it wasn't just this one company that McCain acted on behalf of. He's written a lot of letters on behalf of a lot of companies. I would imagine we're probably going to see some of those letters, come out again in the aftermath of this. But, this is the problem. McCain has sort of been running as the guy, the reformer that wants to push back against lobbyists and push back against a Washington influence. But at the same time, he has definitely played that game. And in some ways, he is, because he's sort of taken this position as being the crusader against all this stuff, there's more scrutiny of what he does.
Well, all last night, as this played out, conservative media hosts, some of whom very much don't like McCain, said that this might open a door for Romney to reenter the race, that it might explain why Huckabee stayed in, that he might have known that this was coming. What are you hearing on the campaign trail as to how this might play out?
I don't think anybody is expecting Romney to jump back in the race, and Mike Huckabee still has, a problem getting all the delegates he needs. But, the fact is that, this is not necessarily a good news story for John McCain. But the one thing I thought was really interesting is that a lot of people that have been critical of John McCain, Sean Hannity, for example, I was watching Fox News, and he was trashing the New York Times for running this story. So I think you might see a wave of sympathy among some of the critics.
The conservative base that he's trying to get on his side.
Right.
Holly Bailey, national political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
British Foreign Secretary David Miliband said today that his country was involved in the secret U.S. Extraordinary Rendition Program. Miliband said two flights, each transporting a single terror suspect, refueled at the British territory of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean in 2002. Miliband said one suspect has been released, the other is still being held at Guantanamo Bay. Meanwhile, at Guantanamo Bay, the system to hear the cases of six men formally charged with plotting the 9/11 attacks is still being finalized. Watching closely, the lawyer for Abu Zubaydah, a Guantanamo detainee who has not yet been charged with anything, even though earlier this month the CIA admitted to waterboarding Zubaydah during interrogation. Well, today we want to have a conversation about Gitmo detainees, and we're going to start with civilian attorney Brent Mickham, who's going to meet today with Abu Zubaydah for the first time. Mickham has represented several other Guantanamo detainees. Also today he's filing what he calls a major legal motion in Zubaydah's case. We spoke with Brent Mickham at the airport on his way to Guantanamo. I asked, who is Abu Zubaydah? Because there's a lot of conflicting information about him.
Well, we really don't know. The only information that I have at this time is what is publicly available. And we have captured essentially all of that information and put it into a petition for habeas corpus, which we will be filing later today in Washington, D.C. What it essentially requires is that the body be produced and that a hearing be given to determine whether someone is rightfully being detained.
And catch us up on what has happened so far with Abu Zubaydah. We read that he did have his Combatant Status Review Tribunal, his CSRT, in 2007. That would mean what? That he's been classified?
What that means is he comes before a tribunal and is determined to be an enemy combatant based, you know, on some evidence which he cannot see and cannot rebut. We have detailed in other proceedings that the CSRT process is nothing but a sham. All of the results are essentially preordained in the other Guantanamo cases that I've been involved with. We've seen instances where tribunal has come back and said that the guy is not an enemy combatant, and they've been ordered to go back and do it again until, you know, the right result is obtained. More importantly now, though, is what evidence will we be able to get our hands on to defend him? Because the information that is out there in the public, I mean, if people start Googling him, it's amazing how much evidence is out there. And that's what we've attempted to do in this filing, is capture what is public, because once I speak with my client, for all intents and purposes, I won't be able to speak again because the terms of the protective order under which I have to labor are incredibly onerous. But based on what we see, I mean, there's another side of the Abu Zubaydah story, aside from what the Bush administration has painted. I mean, if you believe the Bush administration, everybody at Guantanamo is the worst of the worst. And I think the whole world knows that that's no longer the case. You know?
Well, but let's list some of the things that your client has reportedly been accused of. He's been accused of being Osama bin Laden's right-hand man, accused of, in fact, being the operative that Condoleezza Rice was warned about prior to September 11th, being involved in terrorist training camps, accused of being involved in the coal bombing in Yemen. On the other hand, Ron Suskind writes in his book 1% Doctrine, which was published in 2006, that Abu Zubaydah is, in fact, mentally ill.
Well, that's the information that we have, and I would say this. The Bush administration went to great lengths and to publicize the fact that the six high-value detainees were all involved in terrorist activities. And if my client, Abu Zubaydah, were involved in those activities, I feel very confident that he would have been charged. He has not been charged.
That was going to be our question. If, in fact, he was responsible for, as you know, even half of the things, you know, including the 2000 Millennium attack that was thwarted, he's actually been charged by Jordan for another failed bomb attack. You know, why wasn't he charged by the Bush administration?
Well, you'll have to ask them. I mean, you know, I'm the last guy the Bush administration is going to tell anything, and that will always be the case. But I mean, what we know from the public is that there are great questions about this guy. You know, former FBI agent who had access to the files describes Abu Zubaydah as Joe Louis in Las Vegas. I mean, he was just a greeter. He was a guy without any, you know, mental capability. And the Bush administration has essentially made him up to be, you know, the great prize. The fact of the matter is, based on what we know, he is not that. And these are the things that we're going down to find out. And what will be very interesting, for the first time we'll get a chance to talk to him. We'll hear his side of the story. We'll find out what's happened to him, what he's been through, where he's been these past 5 years. He was arrested in March of 2002 when he was attacked and shot three times. He almost died.
Brent, by the way, you are on your way to Guantanamo Bay. You've been there before. You've had clients there before who were released. What are you looking for physically? I mean, we understand they're building facilities to hold these trials of the six who are charged. They're building a death chamber of some sort. These are reports. You know, what will you be looking for when you go there?
Well, we're looking to establish a relationship with him, hopefully one of, you know, some trust, evaluate whether he can assist us in his own defense, then try and plot a way to defend him based on that information.
Brent Mickham, what do you say to Americans who say whether he was, you know, just some sort of low-level valet or whether he was the strategist for Osama bin Laden that the Bush administration says he was? Either way, it's despicable. This is someone who was associated with the man behind the 9/11 attacks. He doesn't deserve any of your time.
Well, I've always thought that that's what this country is about, and that's why I got involved in the early cases. And at that time, it was a very unpopular decision. But it turned out to be the right decision because all of my clients are completely innocent. They are free men now living in Great Britain. And I'm very confident that Abu Zubaydah is not the individual that the Bush administration has characterized him as. I think the facts that are out there in public lend credence to that. And I think what people need to do is to step back and say, in this country, we've always given people a chance to prove whether they're innocent. My feeling is if my man turns out to be a terrorist, well, so be it. If he gets a fair trial, and the country certainly is great enough to give him a fair trial, then he deserves what's coming to him. And if it turns out that he's innocent and has been tortured for years, well, I think people ought to be, you know, big enough to look at that information and say, that was wrong.
Brent Mickham, civilian lawyer for al-Qaeda suspect Abu Zubaydah, who's being held at the Guantanamo Bay facility in Cuba. And Brent's on his way to meet with his client for the first time today. Brent, thanks for your time on the way to your plane. Thank you.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we'll get a response from the Pentagon legal advisor to the upcoming military trials at Gitmo. What about evidence obtained through waterboarding? And later today, Thriller at 25, back in a minute, here and now. We're continuing our conversation about the legal rights of Guantanamo Bay detainees. We just heard from attorney Brent Mickham, who's on his way to the detention center today to meet his client Abu Zubaydah for the first time. Mickham, by the way, told us that he thinks the government will, quote, sanitize evidence obtained from his client, re-interviewing detainees after they've been waterboarded to get evidence into trial without evidence of waterboarding going into trial. Well, joining us now from the Pentagon is Brigadier General Thomas Hartman. He's legal advisor to the military judge convening the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay. General Hartman, I want to give you a chance to respond to some of the things we just heard. First of all, why hasn't Abu Zubaydah, Mickham's client, been charged? When President Bush announced his transfer to Guantanamo in 2006, he said Zubaydah would face a military trial.
The matters of cases that are under investigation and the processes that the prosecutors go through with the intelligence community and the law enforcement community are not things we discuss in public. We wait until things are charged, so that's the fairest way to deal with those things with regard to both accused, counsel, and the government. So we let the facts lead us, and once the facts lead us somewhere, then the prosecutors make a decision whether to charge. As to Abu Zubaydah, those matters are being reviewed, and that will continue, but I wouldn't even begin to give any details about that in public.
Well, then I'm going to move right on to the six charged detainees accused of being 9/11 ringleaders facing the death penalty. What's happening there? Let's start with lawyers. Do these men have civilian lawyers yet? They're supposed to have both military and civilian, but the American Bar Association has said they're going to refuse to participate in helping the Pentagon get civilian lawyers.
Well, one of them has a military lawyer, the sixth person named Mohammed Al-Qahtani. He's been designated as of last week. We have some indications that some of the, at least one of the others, has a civilian lawyer. And then the civilian lawyers are available to them if they choose to use a civilian lawyer, but each one of them will be entitled to a detailed military counsel who will be appointed by the Chief Defense Counsel.
Do you think you're going to have a hard time getting the full plate of civilian lawyers?
I don't know whether they'll have a hard time, but I know that the defense community has been very open and very assertive and very eager to participate in these. For example, in the Hamdan case, which is a case that's going on, has been going on at Guantanamo Bay, there are five counsel that sit at his table, one military, one DOD civilian, two members of a distinguished U.S. law firm, and a member of the Emory University faculty who is a member of counsel. So I think the defense community has eagerly stepped up, and we should be proud of their involvement in these cases.
You mentioned Hamdan, that Salim Ahmed Hamdan, known as Osama bin Laden's driver. Last week, a U.S. military judge allowed his lawyers to submit written questions to top al-Qaeda suspects being held at Guantanamo Bay. Prosecutors won't allow the defense team access to these high-value detainees. Why is that? Why just the written questions?
Well, that's a matter that was debated, Robin, in the courtroom, and the judge made a determination, and that's the rule of law. That's how that's decided. It is the case because under our rule of law, and we are a nation of laws and not of men, the rule of law says that the judge decides. So the judge evaluated the equities on both sides, the law on both sides, the facts, and determined that the most effective way to protect the rights of the accused while protecting the rights that the government might have in connection with any potential information, classified information and otherwise, that information should be dealt with through the interrogatory process.
Well, and let's go further with that, because in your news conference last week, you said the six detainees charged had nearly identical rights to members of the armed forces charged in military courts. You said they have the right to remain silent, to have military and civilian counsel, as we said, the right to cross-examine, the right to be present during trial, and the right to appeal. You also said they had the right to examine all evidence against them. But we understand that the same process applies, that they can only see classified evidence if this judge decides they can. So they don't really have the right to see all evidence against them.
They have the absolute right, without question, to see every piece of evidence that goes to the jury, to the finder of fact, or to the panel. We have different names for them. Every piece of evidence.
But not every piece of evidence goes to the jury.
Well, but those are the pieces of evidence that determine their innocence and guilt and their rights to liberty.
But in this case, the judge can decide not to send classified evidence against these detainees to the jury. They don't get to see it.
If the jury doesn't get to see it, then it's not used to determine the accused's guilt or innocence.
But it might have been used to determine, you know, that they go to trial. In other words, it might have been used against them prior to the trial to get them to the trial.
Well, if any evidence is used to get somebody to trial in terms of what goes into the referral package, that's what gets them to trial, the referral package. And the referral package is discoverable, 100% discoverable by the defense. So if something is used to get them to trial, Judge Crawford is the one that reviews that. I review it, and it goes to the defense in 100% discovery.
Well, what about waterboarding? CIA Director Michael Hayden acknowledges that three Guantanamo detainees have been waterboarded. They include Abu Zubaydah, who has not been charged, but at least one detainee who has been. President Bush says waterboarding is legal. Critics say it's illegal torture. And the British Foreign Service Director David Miliband says he doesn't see how waterboarding isn't going to come into play here in these trials, that defense attorneys are going to want to dig into that.
Well, you wait until you have the trial and you allow the judge who's in the courtroom with the defense counsel, however many there are, the accused, his interpreter, his analyst, and the various other resources available to him, you allow them to challenge the evidence that the prosecution puts forward. The prosecution understands its burden of proof and its burden in connection with the rules of admissibility for the evidence, and they know what they've got to do to try to prove their cases beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is it possible that these men might have been waterboarded, but that would be considered classified and it would not enter into trial?
That's beyond my knowledge.
Huh. This, you know, speculation is that this could go into the next president's watch. Do you at all think about that?
I don't think about that. Our focus is on taking what's in front of us right now, gathering the evidence, assessing that evidence against the law, and proceeding with the cases in a fair, open, and transparent way. We've made extraordinary rights available to these accused, rights that far exceed those available at Nuremberg. We make virtually the same rights available to these people that we make available to our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and the people who defend this nation. And I think most people who are listening out there will consider them a national treasure.
Brigadier General Thomas Hartman, legal advisor to the military judge convening the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay. General Hartman, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Robin.
And still ahead today, New York State takes on Hollywood, asking filmmakers to give movies geared to kids an R rating if any characters smoke. That's after the news, here and now. The U.S. Navy is tracking the debris path of that ailing spy satellite it shot down last night over the Pacific Ocean. The Pentagon says its $10 million missile very likely destroyed the fuel tank with its toxic payload. Pentagon officials were elated this morning at a press conference. Here's Marine General James Cartwright.
You can imagine at the point of intercept last night, there were a few cheers from people who have spent many days working on this project.
But the Russians and the Chinese are not cheering. Well, joining us with one analyst day after view is David Mosier. He's a senior policy analyst on the military at the RAND Corporation. David, the Chinese and Russians were worried about the missile launch before it took place. How are they reacting today?
Well, they're not happy. The Chinese People's Daily issued a statement that was fairly strong, saying the United States had done things that they didn't think were helpful for peace in space. They made reference to a proposed treaty that the Russians and the Chinese tabled at the UN Conference on Disarmament last week, aimed at eliminating or banning the placement of weapons in space. However, if you read the treaty carefully, it does not ban these sorts of activities, either the test that we just did yesterday, nor does it ban the test that the Chinese conducted a year ago. It was their first test and sort of shocked the world when they did it.
Well, let me stop you there, David, to ask you about that, because, you know, the Chinese are, you know, yes, upset, but they did the same thing. They launched a missile to take out a satellite, and they didn't warn people beforehand as the U.S. did.
Right. And not only that, they intercepted a satellite that was at 850 kilometers altitude, right in the middle of a band where lots of satellites are. It created a huge amount of debris. And debris at that altitude takes decades, maybe even up to 100 years, for that debris to settle down to Earth. Debris is a problem because it's like pollution. Other satellites can run into it, or it can run into the other satellites. And the satellites are fragile, and at very high speeds, even little pieces can cause catastrophic damage to satellites.
But why are the Chinese and the Russians so upset that the U.S. has now done this, taken out a satellite?
There are two issues going on. One is that this was as much a test of the United States missile defense, or a component of their missile defense system, as it was an anti-satellite test.
Even though the Bush administration said it wasn't a test of the missile system.
Well, I think what they said was that it was not their intention to do a test, but in the sense that now that it's done, they have data, they hit something, it was a test in that sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was an incident that involved their missile defense system. Both China and Russia are opposed to the United States deploying ballistic missile defenses that could intercept their missiles. There's a big tiff we're having with the Russians now about a proposed U.S. missile defense system that would be placed in Europe, and the Russians have made very strong statements about that system. So one is the missile defense piece. There's another piece, which is the United States over in this administration has made very strong statements about space and U.S. operations in space. And their latest space doctrine, for example, basically took the position that the U.S. Has the right to space, and we also have the right to deny other people the opportunity to operate in space during a conflict. The motivation for all this is the United States is very reliant on satellites for conflict, for war. We're also very reliant on satellites commercially. And so there is a concern that one of our big edges, our ability to move information around quickly in operations on a battlefield, could be limited if our satellites are targeted. And satellites, as you can see what we just did to our own satellite, are very vulnerable. If you hit them with something, you blow them up. Mm. And there was a report that was done by Secretary Rumsfeld, shortly before he became secretary, that looked at space and warned of a space Pearl Harbor where our enemies might attack us. I happen to think that was way overblown, but there is a concern that in the middle of a conflict that our satellites could be targeted. And the major thrust of this really is China. I mean, the administration won't say it, but that's really what it's all about. They use terms like near peer or near peer competitor to talk about countries that may do this.
What is the law? What's the existing law about military in space?
Well, it's very vague. Some of it is law that's in treaty, and very little in the treaties tell you anything about what you can do in space except base nuclear weapons in space. We can't base them on celestial bodies, meaning essentially the moon. But in terms of actual having spy satellites or even conducting these ASAT tests, these anti-satellite tests, there really is no law that tells you what to do. Now, there are many procedures that states use, particularly on the commercial side, but governments honor them too, trying to minimize the debris. Everyone sees the debris as a problem. And there's a treaty that guarantees the right to peaceful use of space to any nation. So the current state of affairs, if you will, is that anybody who wants to put a satellite up can, and they can operate it peacefully without interference. Things become trickier when you talk about combat operations on the ground and how or if they stretch to space. If the Chinese had not tested last year, doing this operation that the Navy did would have been seen as much more controversial, both internationally and domestically. And it was still viewed as controversial, but it had been much more so.
But on the other hand, David, wouldn't it have been disastrous if this satellite, the size of a school bus filled with toxins, hit the Earth?
Well, no. No one says that it would be disastrous.
It would be disastrous if it hit you.
Well, yeah, true. But much of the Earth is ocean, and much of the land masses are very sparsely populated, so that the probability of being hit by space junk is very small. There's a lot of junk up there, and it ultimately ends up coming down. Much of it gets burned up, but some of it doesn't. So the concern that the Pentagon raised was the concern of this hydrazine fuel. They didn't talk about the risk of it hitting somebody and hitting the ground. What they talked about was the risk of the contamination from that fuel. And that contamination would be, in their words, about the size of a couple football fields. And it's not that if you breathe the stuff, you'd keel over dead instantly. This would be something that you'd have to stick around for a little while and inhale to die.
So you seem to be agreeing with, for instance, the editorial page of the Los Angeles Times that says that, yes, maybe the U.S. eliminated that risk, but opened the door to other risks in foreign relations, a high price to pay to offset a highly unlikely danger.
They certainly opened the door to more tests, and what it did do was undermine our ability to sort of take the high road, if you will, in dealing with other countries that test. The U.S. reaction to the Chinese was fairly strong. It was mostly couched in terms of the debris that they created, which was just a terrible mess. And they've been beaten up sort of by the U.S. government, but many sort of non-government organizations and other countries have given them a hard time about that. So in this case, this test was different. We're, you know, the debris will deorbit within a few weeks. But we've reduced our ability to make case that you shouldn't be doing these things for the Chinese anyway.
David Mosher, senior policy analyst on the military at the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. David, thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's take a look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, colleges are building huge gyms, but are students using them too much? We're going to meet a grad student who will tell us she had to get professional help for what kids are calling gymorexia.
I was a gym rat, and like every bodybuilder and I were like good friends, and it's just like I lived there, and I thought like, why not lose all this weight? I did, and it became very powerful. It's an extremely addicting feeling to be attractive and to, like, get attention.
Also on our radar screen for our upcoming shows, we'll talk with New York Times business writer Joe Nocera about the copyright battle going on between Harry Potter creator J.K. Rowling and fair use advocates. And later this month, the New York Philharmonic travels to North Korea for a series of performances. What part will politics play? These stories coming in the days ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. The The New York State Health Commissioner wants movie studios to cut smoking out of films aimed at young people. In full-page ads in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal this week, the commissioner claimed 200,000 young people started smoking because it was portrayed in movies they watched, even animated films like The Ant Bully. In 2006, the American Medical Association listed that film as one of the worst offenders for glamorizing smoking.
Enjoy your world. That's entirely bug-free.
Let's give this human a goodbye kiss.
Pucker up, Mr. Beale!
Oh! Actor Paul Giamatti was the voice of a cigar-chomping exterminator in Ant Bully. Well, joining us is the New York State Health Commissioner, Richard Daines. And, you know, Ant Bully, you've got that exterminator. He's kind of the bad guy. He's chomping on this ugly cigar. It's not exactly, you know, glamorous like James Dean.
We have excellent longitudinal studies of adolescents, and the more smoking they see in movies, the more likely they are to try smoking. And we control that for every other factor, whether their parents smoke and other things. And smoking in movies, putting images of smoking in front of these adolescents, results in more smoking.
In fact, the University of California estimates that 390,000 teens started smoking because of depictions in films. And that translates to $4.1 billion in lifetime sales for the tobacco industry because they get kids started younger. With that kind of money at play, do you think your ads, you know, your appeal is going to have an impact?
Well, we hope this is a call to conscience. We asked for four things. If there's smoking in movies, to rate it R, to assure us that they're not being paid to place tobacco in the movies, to not do brand placement, and to have anti-smoking ads whenever we have a movie that has tobacco use, whether it's rated R or not.
Let's take those one at a time. Rated R. I mean, Ant Bully. We keep referring to Ant Bully, the story of a boy who turns into an ant because he used to kill them, you know, an animated film. I mean, can you really get that rated R?
No, the answer to that is to get the smoking out of those kind of movies. Mm-hmm. If movies are, I presume Ant Bully is targeted at kids, tobacco use doesn't belong in a movie like that.
Yeah. Can you think of a movie that illustrates what you're talking about? I mean, besides, you know, the cigar-chomping character in Ant Bully?
Lord of the Rings, the version, the one called Fellowship of the Rings, rated PG-13. There were 24 episode scenes of smoking in it.
I understand it was Gandalf, and he made it look very cool.
Okay. And if you looked at U.S. adolescents age 10 to 14, 12.5 million adolescents saw that movie. That means there were 300 million what we call smoking impressions. That's the 12.5 million times the 24 scenes of smoking in that movie. How much would you pay for that in advertising?
In November of 2006, Philip Morris ran ads in Variety and other trade magazines asking filmmakers not to use their products in films.
Well, again, we get gestures that they're voluntarily going to do these things. We want more than just the gestures. If they're not doing it, then fine. All we ask for is that be certified in the credits of the movie.
Well, the Motion Picture Association of America said last year that it would think about how smoking is portrayed when deciding ratings. And according to the ratings board, the percentage of films that included smoking has been dropping from 60% to 52% from 2004 to 2006. So could they say, well, you know, we're trying?
Well, no. They agreed to that in May of 2007. The University of California, San Francisco, went back in November of 2007 and looked at the results, and they found really no fall off in the number of tobacco impressions that were being given.
Do you think that there's ever a time in a young person's film where the art might cry out for someone to smoke, and an actor might need that?
We do understand there needs to be an exception when they're portraying historical characters that were known to smoke. I can't see that if you're putting out an animated movie for kids, that a character that smokes is essential to the plot development. One of the interesting things about the research is that it's very durable. You put an impression in front of a 10-year-old, they're more likely to start smoking at 14 or 15. And whether it was portrayed favorably or unfavorably, just putting that in front of the kid seems to have an effect.
Richard Daines, New York State Health Commissioner. Commissioner, thanks so much for speaking with us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And we come back. We're going to moonwalk back to the 80s for an anniversary edition of Michael Jackson's Thriller. That's in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It may seem hard to believe, but it's been over a quarter of a century since Michael Jackson's album Thriller first hit the stores. Over 25 years. And yet, did anyone not get it when supermodel Naomi Campbell and several lizards did the Thriller dance in a commercial for So Be Life Water during the Super Bowl? When they thwacked their tails. Well, this month, a special 25th anniversary edition CD and DVD set of Thriller was released. And here to talk about the impact of the original, here now pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, did you love the lizards?
I absolutely love the lizards. It made me laugh. It was one of the better commercials during the Super Bowl.
Squatting and doing the stomp with their hands on their thighs.
Even without the song, you would have known exactly what they were doing.
That's right, without the music. Well, remind us. The original video was groundbreaking, but it wasn't the first off the album.
No, the first video off the album that got any airplay was Billie Jean, which was also notable because it was the first time MTV had played a video by a black artist. She was more like Billie the Queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one who could dance on the floor around. The short story is MTV had been around for 2 years, almost 2 years when Thriller came out. And at that time, MTV was not playing any black artists. And they went to MTV with the video for Billie Jean and presented it, and MTV essentially said, no, thank you.
They said no?
They said no, ignoring the fact that Michael Jackson was already a huge star by that point. He'd had all the years with his brothers in the Jackson 5, and also Off the Wall had come out about 4 or 5 years earlier. So he was already a huge star when they turned this down.
Why'd they turn it down?
Because they didn't play black artists. It wasn't an official rule, but it certainly was the status quo at the time.
And it was also a song about a paternity suit and he's not
right,
my child.
But I think that had nothing to do with it. I think
okay.
It was more the fact that Michael Jackson was black. And essentially what happened was Walter Yetnikoff, who was then president of CBS Records, Michael Jackson's label, threatened MTV and said, if you don't play this video, I'm going to pull all the videos from all CBS artists. And in those days, there weren't that many videos. MTV couldn't afford that, so their hand was forced. And in March of 1983, they finally played Billie Jean, which immediately... immediately a huge hit
right.
For both Michael Jackson and for the station.
Now, did Beat It come next?
Beat It came next. And by that point, Thriller was well on its way to just selling zillions of copies every week.
The album
Thriller was number one for the longest time. I mean, it was a phenomenon. I can't really think of anything like that before or after it about a single album.
And Beat It, of course, was to be an homage to West Side Story. So it had this great dance.
Michael Jackson, you know, a great lover of old Hollywood, you know, always looked for an opportunity to tip his hat that way. And that's what he does with Beat It.
And then we come to Thriller. It's more of a mini movie. Tell us about the song Thriller.
The song Thriller, in a way, it was the title song, but it was kind of a throwaway song. It's a pretty average song. There's nothing special about it. But then Michael Jackson wanted to do something to boost the album again. It had already sold many, many copies, was already in the top 10, but was sliding down a little bit, and he needed something to get the album back in the spotlight. So he goes to John Landis, who had directed An American Werewolf in London and Animal House, and asked him to direct this video. And at the time, videos were usually like 3-minute promotional clips, and he did this 14-minute mini movie that cost $800,000. Some have said as high as $1 million. And in those days, videos probably cost under $100,000.
And we understand, after the video was made, that the music was re-edited to match the video.
Right, because the video was 14 minutes long. The song itself was not that long. But once they had this video with that amazing dance sequence, people wanted to be able to listen to the song and do the full dance to it as well.
Okay, so, you know, we're radio, obviously, but as we listen, a lot of people probably know the head snapping, the
forward with your left shoulder, forward with your right.
And the fact that they were zombies. This was, you know, characters looked like they stepped right out of George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, and suddenly here they were dancing and popping and locking and breaking, and it was amazing. I remember staying up late to see the premiere on television and just sitting there with my jaw on the floor. I couldn't believe this was a music video.
Choreographed by Michael Peters, and Vincent Price, the actor, has, you know, a speaking part. Mm-hmm. But what is it, Renee, about both the music that you're hearing and what you're seeing? What is it?
It's fun. The dance steps are complicated, but not so complicated that you can't do it at a wedding or at your bar mitzvah. You put Thriller on and someone is going to strike that pose and start behaving like a dancing zombie. And, you know, the song was fine, but it was the video that has the real resonance more so than the song. The video really made the song, not the other way around. You take a song like The Twist by Chubby Checker, that's a song about a dance. Thriller's not about a dance, but the dance became so closely associated with the song that it's kept it going for now decades.
And immortalized in movies like Jennifer Garner's film 13 Going on 30, she plays, it's like a big for a girl, she plays someone who overnight turns 30 and there's a big office party and nothing's happening until she gets everyone out on the floor.
People start doing these dance steps and it's, you know, it never really goes away. You know, 6-7 years ago, a band named Alien Ant Farm had this huge breakthrough hit with a cover of Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal, but in the video there were all these references to Billie Jean, to Beat It, but also to Thriller. That same year, the British band Gorillaz had a song out called Oddly Clint Eastwood, and there were animated gorillas, and they were dancing to Thriller. I mean, and just not to the song Thriller, but just doing the dance steps to the song Clint Eastwood. It just keeps going on and on. There's all sorts of videos. Type in Thriller and dance on YouTube, and untold numbers of things will pop up.
We have to mention one of them, the internet phenomenon in August last year when a video of Filipino prisoners, they were dancing to the song. They became this internet hit for their dance of Thriller.
Just rows and rows of men in their prison orange jumpsuits. It could have been a wedding if not for the orange jumpsuits. But it's that familiarity. It's one of the great sort of pop cultural touchstones of all time in my mind.
Well, and if you missed out on it, as we said this month, a special 25th anniversary edition CD and DVD set of Thriller. You can now, in the comfort of your own home, learn it yourself and teach it to kids. I mean, what a fun thing.
You know, do it while you're waiting for the train in the morning. Teach it to the kids. Teach it to the grandkids. 50 years from now, Thriller will come on and somebody will go through those moves.
Speaking of 50 years, Michael Jackson, the man who brought us Thriller, has a milestone coming up.
On August 29th, Michael Jackson turns 50.
I can't believe it. That's Here and Now pop culture critic Renee Graham on the continuing impact of Michael Jackson and his Thriller. Renee, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.